This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Welcome to the Friday morning break with John Gibbs on Teachers Talk Radio. My guest this week, Naomi Eisenstadt, first director of Sure Start. We discuss the success, the failures, and the missed opportunities of the Sure Start program.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Over the last few weeks and months, I've been exploring what schools are for, and it strikes me that one of the most obvious things is to provide opportunities equitably for everybody. And yet it's patently obvious that our schools simply don't do that. In fact, it may be argued that the education system exaggerates and exacerbates social inequality, or even engineers it. So this week's guest, Naomi Eisenstadt, who was the first director of the Sure Start program, provides an ideal insight into a bold program to extend success and opportunity for all students and all young people. After a long career in the NGO sector, Naomi Eisenstadt found herself as the first director in 1999 of the Sure Start program, a major program that rapidly developed and ran right across the country. Its aim was to reduce the gap in outcomes between children living in disadvantaged areas and those in the wider population. In a sense, our discussion today will explore the rise, the rapid rise, the successes, to some extent, the fall of the Sure Start program, and what remains of it, what it achieved, and what it has yet to achieve. After leaving Sure Start, Naomi has done many things, writing books, Deputy Chair of the Poverty and Equalities Commission, and 3 years Director of the Social Exclusion Task Force. She's also a career civil servant, and since retiring, Naomi has chaired the Camden Equalities Commission, the Milton Keynes Poverty Commission, and written many articles relevant to child development and child poverty. She's also the trustee of numerous charities, including Save the Children, the Standard Life Foundation, the Dartington Social Services Lab. Naomi is also an honorary research fellow at the University of Oxford Department of Education. She was awarded an honorary doctorate from the Open University in 2002, and in 2005 became a Companion of the Bath. I reached out to Naomi a couple of weeks ago, hoping she'd be a guest on my show, partly because the Institute for Fiscal Studies had produced a report which suggested that the long-term effects of Sure Start were beginning to show themselves in improved exam results for students, particularly from disadvantaged areas and disadvantaged backgrounds. This brought Sure Start back into the news, so it seemed a good time to reflect on its past, its history, and its development. I also know Naomi from the past, indirectly, since I taught her son Nathan his A-level politics many years ago. So I was very pleased when Naomi agreed to come on the show. And we're back as the music dies away on Teachers Talk Radio. And my guest this week, Naomi Eisenstadt, who indirectly I've known for a few years, as I said in the introduction. But also what we're going to talk about is something in the news. And although I've thought of you as a guest, Naomi, as I said before, on a number of occasions, today we're going to talk about Sure Start. So Naomi Eisenstadt, welcome to Teachers Talk Radio.
Thank you very much, John. It's lovely to be here.
Well, I heard you last week and this prompted me to contact you because you were on Radio 4. And the reason you're on Radio 4 is because Sure Start is back in the news. It's not gone away entirely. We'll talk about that. But Sure Start's in the news because of the IFS report. I'd like to start at the beginning. You were the first director of Sure Start. And if we go back to the 1990s, it was a Labour programme which had its origins, if we go look at it, talking about its origins, had its origins in the United States with an idea, with a programme called Head Start. But I think even before that, there was lots of research that talked about the impact of things early on in life, what they call the thousand golden days and so on. So where did Sure Start have its origins, with the idea start and so on?
It's there's several different paths to get to it, but the main issue when I talk about the beginnings of Sure Start, it's different from Head Start in a variety of ways, but certainly I would say the origins were a lot of work done in Britain on early years anyway because of good nursery education, but it was all up to local authorities whether you had anything at all. And of course, big voluntary sector organizations and small voluntary sector organizations. The playgroup movement was very much involved in the early years. There was a whole issue about the question I asked in Parents, Poverty in the State was, so what is the role of government? And the Sure Start story, so what is the role of government between birth and school? Because the role of government, yes, technically between birth and school is health. That was before the 1997 Labour government, the role of government for young children, the role of the government for young children was basically a health role in terms of midwifery care, maternity care, and then health visiting. But everything else was basically up to local authorities, and some local authorities did amazing things and some local authorities didn't do much at all. But I think the other important origins was about New Labour. And one of the things that New Labour was very interested in doing was this thing called joined up government, that Whitehall departments, yes, didn't work collectively together, that there weren't common goals. So Norman Glass, who was a brilliant civil servant in the Treasury, decided that instead of doing just government by the government spending reviews, there should be a spending review on some cross-government issues. And they did one on drugs, and they did one, I think, on youth crime. But they also did one on services for young children. And Norman was the civil service chair of the Comprehensive Spending Review for Services for Young Children. And the ministerial lead was Tessa Jowell. And it was out of the evidence from that review that Sure Start was born. And what was interesting about the way Labour was working at the time, which was relatively new, was that they talked to a lot of outsiders. So I was then running a medium-sized children's charity. I was, my background was children in poverty, and particularly early years in poverty. I had worked for 5 years on Bean Hill, one of the low-income estates in Milton Keynes, setting up a nursery. So one of the people that Norman Glass came to see was me, and saw lots and lots of other people. But basically Norman, as a Treasury civil servant, wasn't used to getting out there. And I took him to two of our projects that the Family Service Units, the charity I was running at the time, was running in Birmingham, one in South Birmingham, which was mainly poor white, and one in East Birmingham, which was almost entirely Bangladeshi and Pakistani. And what I wanted to show Norman at the time was how different, even within 5 miles in the same city, communities can be, and therefore the services that you design at neighborhood level need to really respond to communities.
Yeah, and what convinced Labour that this was a thing they needed to do?
Well, there was a huge amount of research that if you got in early, you saved a lot of money later on.
Right.
It was about getting children school ready. And it was also about, sadly, what we still have is the gap in outcomes between children from poor backgrounds and the wider child population. Mm. So there were, emerging even then, you know, anti-poverty strategy like female labor market participation. So in the 1997 labor manifesto was a promise of a national childcare strategy. There was also a promise of free universal early years education for four-year-olds and eventually for three-year-olds, but in the parliament for four-year-olds. So already in the 1997 manifesto, they had looked at a lot of evidence about intervening early, but it was still quite siloed. The cross-government review, once they were in power, began to look at much more integrated approaches in terms of bringing services together at neighborhood level.
And this was the sort of the new thing, in a sense, about Sure Start.
The new thing was it wasn't just childcare and it wasn't just education. It was parenting services. It was advice on benefits. It was employment. It was bringing all the services together, one-stop shop within a community. But the other thing that was relatively new in terms of government was engaging local parents in the governance of each of the programs, which was identified in the IFS report that recently published about how important that was. And I've begun to think more and more how important that is.
Mm.
But I have to say, in terms of new thing, Norman had visited centers that were operating in that way. There were a lot of good integrated centers that were dotted around England, Coram Family and Hillfields in Coventry and Corby, Pengreen and Corby were already operating in those sorts of ways, but it was piecemeal around the country. There were a few great projects or great centers running, but there was no national program on integrating services for children. And it's important to say that my role in Sure Start was England. It was a devolved policy. Yes. So Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland got their own money. And Northern Ireland never cut their Sure Starts. They still have them.
I was going to come on to that because I think in Scotland it's called something like Best Start and Wales Flying Start. Still exists.
Yeah, that's right.
So there we are in 1990. You've got late 1990, Labour comes into power. They've got a big majority. Yeah. And you've got the models to show. You can take a minister to somewhere and say, look, this is what you could do. It wasn't like a theoretical thing. And it helped, of course, that the economy was doing okay. So at the time, one of those few times Labour comes to power and they're not in the middle of an economic crisis. So they've actually got some money to spend. So they were convinced. And how big was Sure Start for those people who don't know or don't remember? When Sure Start starts to roll out, what was the first iteration of Sure Start?
The first iteration was 60 trailblazers, but in terms of the planning, the first iteration was 250 local programs, which would cover the 20% poorest children in England, and basically urban, because it was what's called an area-based initiative. So you identified areas that had a significant number of very poor young families, and you put the services there, but then you didn't target on individual families. They were open to everyone once the area was chosen. And these were very small areas. They were between 400 and 800 under fours would be included. So very small. Probably about the size of a primary school catchment area.
Yeah.
Meant to be what we call pram pushing distance. You know, when...
Yes.
Yes, which is the critical feature.
You've got to be able to get there.
You can walk there, and it's neighborhood, and it's open access, and the precise selection of services on offer in any single center was up to a local board that was made up of local parents, but also service providers in the area. So you'd have somebody from health, somebody from education, somebody from social care, voluntary sector, whatever. And the main manager of the local program could be a voluntary sector organization operating locally, or it could be local government, or it could be health. So you wanted someone who was the caretaker to oversee the development, but a board to decide what should be on offer and to keep the thing going, but also a banker So the banker didn't necessarily have to be the organization that was the lead provider, because you wanted to separate out the power from the money. If the power and the money are in the same place, it's going to be local government or health. It's not going to be a voluntary organization.
Was there any resistance to that? Was that something that Labour embraced right away? I mean, governments tend to want to control things and mandate what's done.
I mean, actually,
when you try to make it local.
It was Paul Johnson asked me this. I think that certainly at whatever the DfE was called at the time, I think it was Department of Education and Education and Employment, because it changed several times. But whatever, you know, at the time, as you will know as a teacher, that there was a national literacy strategy, there was a national numeracy strategy, there was enormous amounts of central control on almost everything, unprecedented central control.
Yes.
And I think the reason that they allowed incredible amounts of flexibility at local level is that compared to those things, this was quite small. Our first budget, which for me was like, I'd never heard of such numbers in my life, 450 million over 3 years. So uh-huh. I went from running a medium-sized children's charity, which was 6 million a year, to 450 million, which was terrifying. But in government spend terms, it was not a lot of money.
Did
and
you,
that's
when
what's
you
astonishing
at,
now.
When you looked at bits of paper, yeah. Did you just have to knock the numbers off and say that now it looks realistic? Yeah. Knock the zeros off, rather. Yeah. I can understand it.
Yeah.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher, or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Break with John Gibbs, and my guest this week, Naomi Eisenstadt, First Director of Sure Start. We discuss the Sure Start program, its success, its failures, and its missed opportunities. You were involved right from the beginning. That was so. It was you doing this.
Yeah,
as it
I was
were,
the first
and
director.
And yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But the key, people refer to me as the architect. The key architect was Norman Glass in the Treasury. And just, it's very interesting that that was something that was incredibly new, that policy was emanating from the Treasury, not just the departments argue for the money and then the Treasury gives them the money. The Treasury, in this case, was determining what the money was for. And
right.
It was ring-fenced. So the Department for Education couldn't take any of the Sure Start money and spend it on secondary schools or on teaching French. It was for young children. And that was the level of policymaking in the Treasury was part of, you know, you might be old enough to remember the Granisa deal.
I don't actually
Gordon know. Brown and Tony Blair decided who, when
the flipping
when
of
Smith
the coin,
died. When John Smith died.
Yes.
Yeah. When John Smith died, Gordon Brown and Tony Blair had dinner and decided
yes.
who was going to be leader of the party, which as an American, I found absolutely extraordinary. Anyway, and part of the deal of okay, Tony, you can be prime minister, but as chancellor, I will have significantly more involvement in domestic policy.
So
which
that,
was extraordinary.
In that sense, you've got the muscle of the Treasury and Gordon Brown, formidable muscle behind you.
Yeah. Couldn't be better. And they, you know, and as Shaw started to roll out and became very popular, they were in competition for for credit for Shawstock. So as a civil servant, you know, I'd never been a civil servant before. You know, I was running a charity, so I didn't understand how unusual this was, but it was very unusual.
So when you met Tony Blair, you said, brilliant idea, Tony. And when you met Gordon, you said, that's great. So that was the first phase. How long did that last and what came next?
Well, the next 250 programs was determined in 1998, and we started in 1999. There was a spending review in 2000. Spending reviews were every 2 years, but for a 3-year rolling cycle. So the next spending review was 2001, and ministers took the decision to double the size of the program from 250 to 500. And Norman argued against it. I argued against it because we didn't know anything. We hardly had done anything. It took, you know, it takes a very long time to spend money at local level where there's no infrastructure. So getting buildings built, deciding where to put it, hiring new people. This was all very time consuming. So the idea that you would double it before you knew anything about whether it was working or not. And we had only just commissioned the evaluation. So the evaluation was only just we knew nothing. And I can say, I can say out loud now, I'm sure she won't mind. Yvette Cooper said to me, Naomi, you're nuts. Everybody loves it. And there's an election coming up. Of course, we're going to double it. which, as a civil servant, it should be very flattering and very good. I thought it was too early. Yeah. But we doubled it then. So that was, to 500 local programs, which would now that, once you expand, then you get slightly less poor. So we were covering 1/3 of the poorest kids. One of the problems with Sure Start, and it's important to say, is that the design really works for urban areas. It doesn't work for poverty in rural areas. Because that open access story works when you have really dense concentrations. So we have to work out other ways to reach poor kids in rural areas.
Earlier when you were saying the pram pushing distance, that really doesn't apply
in a rural
area.
But also the concentrations, the critical mass of people you need to provide a service that's open access rather than targeted. Yeah.
Right.
Because you want to make sure that your open access reaches a significant number of the poor kids.
Yeah, which you're going to find the concentration population and so on in urban areas.
Exactly.
So you were convinced, again, slightly aghast, but convinced that it should be doubled in size.
No, I wasn't convinced, but it doesn't matter. I mean, ministers make the decisions.
Right.
We advised against it. They said, no, we're going to do it. So we did it, And there's a further story later on in terms of the expansion that I'm convinced is problematic, but that's a different story. This one, that's how it works as a civil servant. I mean, you give advice and they either take it or they don't, but it's okay. It wasn't terrible.
Were you worried from the beginning that if you expand a thing too quickly, government politics is very fickle. And what's a good idea one week can become a terrible idea the next. And also the financial climate can change. And you thought, well, if this isn't properly embedded, someone's going to say, well, this isn't working. Never mind. You want to establish that it was working first before you commit?
Yes, and of course, ministers could not believe that it wouldn't work. I mean, they were incredibly enthusiastic in the best possible way. I mean, the other thing that Yvette Cooper said that I think is really right, I mean, that I'm really proud of, is that it was the first program aimed at poor people that government set up, aimed at poor people that everybody wanted. I mean, that's astonishing success. It's never happened before. So in that sense, it's part of the expansion. And the 250 to 500 wasn't the big issue. The big issue was in 2003-04, the decision that every area would have a Sure Start Children's Center. And that was part of the 2004 10-year childcare strategy.
Right.
And that was a mistake. And of course, the IFS report says that, that the real effectiveness demonstrated in the IFS report only relates to those first 500 programs. And the reason for that is that as the number of programs expanded, the number of children's centers expanded, the funding for each of them thinned out. And the impact thins out because, you know, you're not being able to do the intensive work in the areas of deep poverty that you were doing. You have it for everyone. On the other hand, and this is the one that I really struggle with personally, is that had you not expanded, then we would not be having this discussion because it would have sunk without trace on, you know, day one of the 2010 election. It would have just sunk. Because if they right. kept it only small in poor areas, you can cut it and nobody notices because nobody complained. You know, the general public don't get upset when things are cut for poor people.
Yes,
but
of course.
Because yeah. it was everywhere, you know, David Cameron's mother was on the picket line not to close their local children's center. You know, it
yes.
was enormously popular across population, which is, you know, which is massive success.
And so once it was up and running, so you had misgivings about how once it became big that it wouldn't be properly funded. How did that manifest itself? If you went to a Sure Start Centre, and that was the cornerstone of the Sure Start program were the
yeah.
centres, and if you went to a Sure
yeah.
Start Centre and you thought, did you see that this wasn't working the way it should work in some areas?
Not really. I mean, because my main visiting was in the early days. You know, I was
right.
visiting fewer and fewer when there were 3,500 from when there were 250 or 500. But
yeah.
there were requirements that were changed. And one crucial requirement that was changed is in the early days, it was required to have childcare on site, which I think was really important to have early education and it was required to have a teacher, QTS, on site.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily running the integrated program, but, you know, we already had evidence from EPI and now EPSI, you know, from Kathy Silver and Pam Salmon's seminal work on the effectiveness of early years, that high quality makes a difference to poor kids and that you get high quality with a teacher. And, of course, now we're still arguing that. Kathy and I did a report quite recently for Nesta on how important quality is in that. You know, the emphasis now is on childcare and free hours, which is for workforce participation. It's not for child development. For child development,
yeah.
you need highly trained staff. So as we expanded, we lost the push on childcare in everyone. We lost the push on a teacher because once you don't have childcare, then you don't need a teacher. So there were things that were thinned out in the requirements of what they had to do. And, you know, it's not about being party political. It is true that under Gordon Brown, when he was prime minister, even as we expanded, the funding was disproportionately higher in the poorest areas. So the funding of the initial programs was pretty much maintained. It's that as new programs came on site, new children's centers came on site, they not only had less money, they were required to do less things, which is quite right if they have less money. So it just became diluted. And once government changed it, the dilution, the coalition promised to maintain children's centers, you know, which was fine. But then what they called a children's center became more and more diluted. So you would have an area, a whole local authority might have 5 or 6 children's centers, but the money advice was in one of them, the employment advice was in another one, and the health visitor visited in another one only on Tuesdays. So the idea that you need some advice, you just go to your local, you push a pram and go to the local place. You have to know which days they're open, what services are open on which days, and they became what's called hollowed out, you know. And of
yeah.
course, once you diminish what's on offer, then people stop coming. When people stop coming, of course, you close it. She's quite right. So
yeah.
there has to be a minimum service offer for the joined up services to work and a minimum service offer that is regular. Because if you're aiming to reach the people who are least likely to participate, but most likely to benefit, you make it as easy as possible, not just in terms of near to their home, but what's on offer is clear. Yeah. So that hollowing out was really the key problem. And that was post 2010.
Was the hollowing out? So that's in the coalition. Austerity. So it was a financial decision. It was, we can't afford as much as we used to afford. So
yeah. Well, in fairness, the big financial decision was to remove the ring fence. Yeah, up until 2010, actually it was 2012, I think, when they removed the ring fence. I'd have to look up the exact date. But once money was absolutely designated for early years, then you could keep your Sure Starts running or your children's centers running. Once you remove the ring fence and you're cutting local authority budgets by up to 40%, then of course, they have statutory responsibilities. They just can't do it. So, it was definitely austerity, and it was definitely removing the ring fence. But the other big decision, which was a labor decision, which at the time made sense to me, but I agree now that it really lost some of the soul of Sure Start, is that in 2004, not only was the decision to expand, the decision was to give the money to local government and for local government to run the programs, which, given that we had now directors of children's services and Every Child Matters and a much stronger emphasis on what local government should do for children in a locality, you couldn't have a director of children's services in charge of everything except the three Sure Start centers. So I understand why it happened. But a consequence of that is that many local authorities remove the requirement to have parents on boards. So a lot of the community engagement, community participation in the actual decisions of how you spend the money at neighborhood level was lost.
That decision to not have parents on the boards, was that just thoughtless, or was there behind that thought that what parents will do is they'll complain or they'll ask for more?
I don't know. Again, I mean, local government, some were very good and maintained it, and some just didn't. It's difficult to manage. Makes things more complicated. Maybe it's that local government thinks that they're essentially democratic anyway because they're elected local. But anyway, it was a very serious issue for us.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
According to reports on the BBC News website, the EU wants to agree a deal with the UK that would make it easier for people aged between 18 and 30 to study abroad in the wake of Brexit. The European Commission says it would be a limited arrangement, not the restoration of freedom of movement. The UK already has schemes with some non-EU countries, and these allow people to come to the UK for up to 2 years. Downing Street says it's open to extending this to individual EU members rather than throughout the EU, but prefers country-by-country deals. The proposed EU scheme has time limits, and UK participants would only be able to stay in the EU country that accepted them. The report goes on to say that it would reduce controls on young people moving between the UK and EU. The European Commission says it is stepping in after the UK approached several EU countries to discuss deals. The Commission says it risked differential treatment of EU citizens, and there should be a bloc-wide deal for equality. The UK turned down an offer to continue participating in the EU's Erasmus student exchange after Brexit, but did replace it with the Turing scheme, which provides exchanges worldwide. The BBC South East team have covered concerns expressed by some students that they may run out of ADHD medication during the upcoming exam period. Some students have reported rationing their medication in order to stretch it out following reports of shortages due to an increase in demand and manufacturing issues. ADHD medications are often controlled drugs, which means prescriptions are limited to a month's supply, although some pharmacies also struggle to fill even this. The NHS advises against any changes of dosage without medical advice, but families continue to feel anxious about the possibility of young people struggling through the exam season. The Guardian reports on findings from communications regulator Ofcom, which suggests that a quarter of 3- and 4-year-olds in the UK now own a smartphone. Half of children under 13 are on social media. Online activity by infant school-aged children is rising. These findings could boost the argument of those urging the government to clamp down on social media and phone use by young children. A consultation will likely be launched in coming weeks, according to sources in government. This could include a proposal to ban mobile phone sales to under 16s, one to make it easier for parents to use parental controls on devices, and one to raise the minimum age for social media sites from 13 to 16. Michelle Donlan, Technology Secretary, said children as young as 5 should not be accessing social media. The Ofcom figures come amid what The Guardian says is growing evidence of the impact of social media use amongst children, and the US government refers to it as a profound risk to mental health. The book The Anxious Generation, published in March by a US academic, has been cited as influencing thinking in number 10. The Ofcom survey was based on 2,480 parents of children aged between 3 and 17. The TES reports that absence rates are up again according to latest DfE figures. This is compared with spring 2022 to 23. This is despite the government's ongoing attendance drive. Overall absence for last term was 7.3%, slightly up on the 7% in the previous year. The Department for Education said the rise was likely to have been caused by a higher level of illness absence. The proportion of persistently absent pupils has also slightly increased to 21.9% of pupils who were missing 10% or more half days. The figures for disadvantaged pupils are worse when compared to their peers. Full details of the latest data can be found on TES.com. Finally, the TES also features a report that the Department for Education does not intend to replace current progress measures, known as Progress 8, for the next 2 years. After exploring alternatives, there will be no progress measures published for schools in England in 2024-25 or 2025-26. The cancellation of Year 6 SATs during the pandemic meant that there was no Key Stage 2 attainment data available as a baseline for Progress 8 calculations. Headline attainment measures will still be published and grading will take place as normal. The Department for Education says it intends to return to Progress 8 in 2026-27. Teaching unions welcomed the announcement, but some described it as a missed opportunity to rethink performance tables overall. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Jo Fox.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Break with John Gibbs, and my guest this week, Naomi Eisenstadt, First Director of Sure Start. We discuss the Sure Start program, its success, its failures, and its missed opportunities.
Local governments are historically in this country poorly funded. And then if all you need is an economic crisis. And so in 2008, we get that. Yeah. We get an economic crisis. We get the banking crisis and so on. And then 2010, we've got a austerity and the culling of the quangos and so on. So is it fair to say that Sure Start suffers the death by a thousand cuts? It isn't, no one announces we're ending Sure Start because that would be politically difficult. But instead, it's just slowly being drained of resources.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
Did it?
And in its place in the last few years, in terms of early years, as I said, the key arguments have been about free hours of childcare. But the quality of the childcare in terms of the requirements for the qualifications of staff have really gone down. And even things like an early years teacher, the requirements to have a qualification called early years teacher are not as high as a QTS, which your listeners would be interested in.
Absolutely, of course. And of course, the argument over childcare has been focused very much on getting parents out to work, getting people back to work after the pandemic, and so on, and not the original arguments, which is something much more ambitious about Sure Start, which is based upon the value of early intervention on the lives of children.
Rishi Sunak cares about childcare, he doesn't care about children. and the problem is that if it actually did reduce poverty, I'd be all for it. But in fact, we now have, if you look at CPAG material, we have the majority of children in poor families, at least one person in the family is working, and sometimes two, and they're still poor. So because of flat wages, and of course, again, credit to the government in terms of raising the minimum wage, but we haven't seen yet how that plays out in the child poverty numbers. Our child poverty numbers are going up. So if the strategy to have childcare, accessible, affordable childcare, so that you reduce child poverty, actually was shown to work, I think there's a good argument for it. But it hasn't worked.
No, I mean, from my own experience, I can recall on several occasions, the experience of talking to parents who effectively rarely saw their children because they were both working. Yep. They're working shifts. Yep. They're working a lot all the time. Yep. And so they said, well, we can't get them up in the morning because we're both out, or one of us is out, or my husband's sleeping because he's on nights. And I thought, well, yes, of course. You know, if the solution to the problem is get parents working, what are you left with?
It's a lose-lose.
Yes. Was another problem with Sure Start, in a sense, this is just my guess, really, is that it was often referred to as Labour's flagship or Labour's baby or the great idea of New Labour. It got attached to New Labour. And so when the New Labour came to an end, particularly after the coalition in the Conservative government since then, there was a feeling that, that we can almost demonstrate that was an airy-fairy social experiment that couldn't work. Did it suffer from being seen as attached to Labour?
It certainly has. And I think I have, and I was a civil servant. I was not party political. But oddly enough, I think that seems to be a problem for the current Labour front bench. Who, again, they've been arguing about childcare numbers. Yeah. And their big offer for children so far is breakfast clubs, which is a really good thing. It has a very strong evidence base. Yeah. I'm not against it at all, but I'd like to see a little more about what they're thinking. And my position isn't, who cares about the logo? You know, call it banana. It doesn't matter what you call it. There is a principle about integrated services at neighborhood level for young families that I think is a really important principle that we now have incredibly good evidence works, but it works over a very long time frame. And that's part of the problem for governments, as you know, is that the long time frame is not very helpful. Yeah. I mean, that's why we have such problems about green strategies. It's the same issue about by the time we feel the results of what we're not doing now, this government won't be in power, and probably the next one won't be in power.
Governments want to show, as you say, in short order, that this thing we're doing is working. And you mentioned earlier that they expanded quickly without the evaluation having demonstrated anything. When the evaluation did start to come in, there was a sort of, I remember the headlines being "Sure Start doesn't, you know, underachieves or shown to have limited effect." So when you get to this sort of 2000s and ones and twos, there's a feeling, was there a thing, oh, well, maybe it didn't work?
Yeah, certainly. Later than that, I mean, it was around 2005, our first child impact study was really, really worrying, because actually it did work for most. First of all, one of the things that the evaluation showed was that we picked the right areas. These were unbelievably poor areas with levels of unemployment of 50% and very, very high levels of poverty. Yeah. So we picked the right areas. It was enormously popular. You know, families loved it. Participation was very high. So, and we had a couple of good results in terms of parents. But the really upsetting one, and I actually cried, is that the children of teen mothers were doing worse in Sure Start areas than in non-Sure Start areas, which was absolutely shocking. This was a, you know, one first rule of intervention, do no harm. We were doing harm. And it was to, you know, the teen mothers were the poorest of the mothers. So there was a sort of middle group who, you know, seemed to be okay. But the children of teen mothers, and this was it was 14% of the sample. So significant, you know. So 86% of the sample, reasonably okay. There were a couple of other problems, but that was the big one. Yes. Now, what's interesting in terms of the IFS report, if you see what happened, is that ministers held their nerve. They didn't stop the program. They, you know, commissioned more work to figure out what was going on and why. And what we started doing was what we called assertive outreach. So in the beginning, it was enormously popular. Staff were really busy and working really hard. And everyone who came loved it. And ministers came to visit and they said how wonderful it was. So everybody thought it was okay. And then we got these results and we realized that there were a significant portion of the most disadvantaged families who were not coming forward. And we managed to get data from health authorities locally. And that is another problem as well, is getting the data. Where are the new babies? Where do teen mothers live? Where, you know, and do assertive outreach and do a lot of home visiting, you know, and that turned the tide. So 2 years later, the next series of results said that there were no differences in subgroups. So the teen mothers were coming and they were doing fine and their children were doing fine. So we were beginning to get good results. This was the National Value of Sure Start led by Jay Belsky and Ted Melyush. It was the initial budget for the National Evaluation of Sure Start was £16 million. So again, this is really big money. ministers were furious and blamed the research when we got bad results, but they held their nerve. They didn't cut the funding. We added new money to do this assertive outreach and therefore fix the problem. And that's one of the things about course correction if you do an ongoing evaluation and get reports every couple of years, you can say, aha, this isn't working. What should we do? And that's what worries me the most, is not learning from what isn't working as well as, you know, learning, oh, well, that was great. And it's interesting how much that comes in the IFS report in terms of the money that was spent on outreach seems to have made a massive difference.
obvious when you look back at it that if people aren't coming through the front door because they feel intimidated or because they feel it's not for them or they've heard that people are going to tell you what to do, then it won't work. You have to get them through the front door.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, and my line is if they don't like it, they won't come. Just because they like it, it doesn't mean it helps their kids. And that's that's a very, very difficult balance in terms of doing stuff that people want and doing stuff that we as professionals know will work in terms of improved child outcomes. And you have to do a mix of both because it's a voluntary program. It's not social services mandated. It's, you know, you have to do something that people want. And that's where having parents on the board was so important because you had much better insights in terms of what people would want and what would draw them and all that kind of stuff.
And how did
go ahead.
How the assertive outreach worked. I mean, was that volunteers going from door to door, or was it people identifying the social services people that you go and contact these people?
It was paid people. Yeah, we spent money on it. We had home visitors, and we had, you know, outreach workers, and we had community development workers whose job was to knock on the doors. And knock on the door twice or three times, or, you know, just, you know, say, well, you know, if you're nervous about it, I'll come with you the first time. There'd be somebody that you knew when you arrived, somebody that you knew. And you're right. I mean, one of the key issues for teen mothers is, my guess, is that the mothers who were not that much older, were 22, 23, would be very patronizing. I should say matronizing, not patronizing to them. You know, would treat them like they were kids. You know, and maybe they didn't want tea and biscuits. Maybe they wanted pop or whatever. But you had to do it. If you want to have a Bangladeshi women's group, you need a Bangladeshi woman. You know, if you want to have a father's group, you need a dad. You know, you need to make sure that you're reflecting the community that you're serving and understand what their needs are by talking to them, not just trying to guess it. You know, most of government is wanting people to want what we think is good for them. Some people don't want what we think is good for them, you know. So it's that delicate balance that I think that's the magic of those, you know, of those first sure steps, was a reciprocity, the understanding that people's lives are difficult and that if you do something that makes their life a bit easier that they see and want, then you're more likely to get good results.
And Sure Start survived then. So they learned, as it were, from this. Yeah. It was very disappointing. You were upset by it, but you thought, well, and they since solved that problem. So
yeah, what's the point of doing an evaluation if the only point is to get good news? Yeah, you know, the point is to figure out what isn't working, why, and try to fix it. And all credit to the ministers at the time, because there was huge pressure. The ministers at the time, you know, people like Margaret Hodge and Beverly Hughes, and, you know, were very instrumental in pushing me towards, so what's going on here? How do we fix it? Not, you know, and fighting. I mean, I don't know if any other ministers were saying, this is ridiculous. We have to stop funding, you know. So it was, a lot of it was about optics in the press and stuff, but they held their nerve, which is great. Yeah.
And when the government changed, when you get the coalition and the conservative governments afterwards, They're motivated again by austerity, by financial concerns. Yeah. But is any then bad news, if bad news comes along, or as it were, if research says this isn't working as much as we thought, or it's not well spent, did they grab that and say, well, there you go.
We didn't have. I mean, the last few evaluations in terms of which would have influenced the coalition was the final NESS evaluation, which was talking about better parental mental health, talking about less home chaos, better home learning environment. But what's interesting about it is that we were getting impact on the parents, not on the children. So So the children weren't doing less well. They were doing pretty much the same as their other poor kids in non-Shorestad areas. But the parents were doing much better. Now, of course, that's a slow burn. And we've got the results of the slow burn last week.
Yes.
Because we stopped doing an evaluation in about, and then the conservatives, well, no, the coalition government agreed to an evaluation that had been set up by Labour on the evaluation of children's centres run at Oxford by Kathy Silver and Pam Sammons. And that evaluation found pretty much the same as the Ness evaluation. It found that it was very hard to get hard evidence that cognitively children were doing better because of Shorestad, but the parents were doing better. And you got better parent satisfaction, better mother's mental health, all sorts of things that are indicators of risk to children. One of the reasons that we think that there was less child difference was that by the time these evaluations were happening, there was universal early education. So four-year-olds were all in, a lot of them were in reception classes. And there was universal free 15 hours a week for 3 and 4 year olds. So you evened out the difference in terms of whether they were getting high quality childcare or not between Shorestad children and non-Shorestad children. The additional that Shorestad was adding was all the parent support. So you didn't get much difference in the children, but you got a lot of difference in parent support, in parent support. Now, the theory of change was that the parent support should lead to better child outcomes. And by 2012, I can say that I was seriously questioning that theory of change. And not saying it wasn't worth doing the parent support, because better mother, there were all sorts of reasons why that's a good thing in its own right. But I was personally disappointed in not getting more child effects. And then you roll forward, and IFS has done this report, and all of a sudden we get better, less hospitalization, fewer broken bones,
yes,
less infections in Shorestad kids.
That was 2019.
And then GCSE results. I mean,
yes.
So yeah. I'm as astonished as anyone else, beyond my wildest dreams.
Yes. So initially, when kids arrive at school and they're doing as well as it's working, but that means they're just doing as well as. So you don't, when you measure the kids, you say, well, there's not a difference between them, but the parents are really loving it. It's working with them. Yeah. It's producing a different sort of, well, I'm going to say home environment. And that's going to have its effect. As any teacher knows, I mean, if the parents are on side, if the parents are doing the right things, if you hear from a parent, well, we help them with their homework. Their homework's going to be materially different to if we don't help them with their homework. Anything like that. So if you've you're thinking your whole over time this must work, and then in 2019 you've got this health. That the IFS says health is improved, and now it's saying GCSE results are improved, and probably we'll see A-level results if they go on, or whatever improved. So it must feel quite good right at the moment.
It feels amazing, absolutely amazing, beyond my wildest expectations. Really, really pleased.
So where do we stand? I mean, we mentioned Labour earlier. Labour's very interested in childcare. Where do we stand with the prospects of Shorestad Mark II, or comeback of Shorestad, or there we go?
I mean, I think the most important thing is not to call it Shorestad, because everybody wants to do something new. I honestly don't care. I mean, there's a little bit of me that cares, but I honestly, I think in the scheme of things, there is a principle about what should be on offer for families at local level, particularly in the poorest areas. And that's the difficulty, is that I still believe in terms of best use of taxpayers' money, putting this stuff in the poorest areas is the most important thing to do, and having it open access. Hmm. Open access means there's no stigma. And open access also means that you have to provide something that people want. Once social services, children's social services involved, and a child is deemed to be at risk, there are statutory requirements in terms of involvement. Well, that's a very different feel from God, I'm really fed up. I think that I'll go down and meet some people for a cup of coffee. In the old days when I worked on Bean Hill, it was meet some people for a cup of coffee and a smoke. But thanks heavens, that's not true anymore. Yeah. But yeah. But that idea, I do think that these programs are about the bottom 30%. They're not about the bottom 5%. You know, when you talk about the bottom, you know, 1 to 5%, there's a lot more complex family problems. And you do need you often need some sort of complex statutory intervention, which may be adult mental health or whatever, you know. But if you want to, what I call the families on the cusp, for actually not much money, you do shift the curve. You know, you do just push them over to the right side in terms of not needing more intensive help later on. And of course, Shawstock has shown that in terms of SEND and health and education care plans at age 11 and 16 is significantly reduced by the kids who've been in a Shawstock area. You know, so those principles about shifting the curve, about the 30%, the people whose main problem is not having enough money. You know, and that's personally what I struggle with, is not, you know, do you have Shawstock or childcare or whatever? I struggle with the balance between cash transfers, better benefits, removing the two child limit, and service delivery. Because if the problem is not having enough money, duh, maybe you know.
Give them some money. Yes.
Yeah. Give money, you know. I mean, it certainly helps me.
Yes, absolutely. It's so easy to take for granted the comfortableness of sort of when you have a comfortable existence, to the, how normal that seems. And then, you know, a previous guest of mine on Teachers Talk Radio, I remember I said something along the lines of middle class culture or something of that kind. And he said, well, it's not a cultural matter. He said, he picked me up on this. He said, it's not a cultural thing. It's a resource issue. And the difference between families who can support their children in all sorts of ways and who can't is often just resources. It's time. It's having a laptop. It's having the space at home. It's having the ability to travel and buy. You know, it's cheaper to live when you have money than it is when you don't have money. Oddly enough,
absolutely,
and so on.
Absolutely. And Kitty Stewart's work at LSC was very powerful on this. That, you know, money makes a difference in terms of what you can buy for your kids, you know, books, clothes, holidays, you know, going up, you know, museums in Italy, you know, all the things that we did,
Absolutely.
You know, makes a massive difference in children's life experience. But I think there's something more subtle than that first of all, it's not subtle in terms of the work that Kitty did about family stress. So everyone knows, if you've never had an argument about money with your partner, you're a very, very strange couple, you know. And of course, money problems do make family stress, and family stress is bad for kids. The relationship between whatever the adults are, parents, step-parents, whatever, within the household, has an impact on child outcomes. It's not just a child-parent relationship. So family stress makes a huge difference. And my line is, well, I remember when Norman was first doing his consultation around the country, Norman Glass, and, you know, people were talking about I said, you know, if you put the parenting class in a free laundrette and I can do my washing at the same time, I'm there. But if my washing machine is broken, I'm not going to bother with the parenting course. I'm going to try to, how do I get my washing machine fixed? And I then, you know, after Shawstock for a few years, I was poverty advisor to Nicola Sturgeon and met with a group of parents in Glasgow. And, you know, they were deciding on, so shall I run the tumble dryer or not? Because it's so expensive. The electricity is so expensive. So these women were planning day to day. You know, my life planning tends to be year to year.
Yes.
Yeah, not day to day. You know, and even when I was a student, I never thought about not using a tumble dryer.
No.
It does, you know, give you a sense of, I always consider myself really lucky because in my work, I've always reminded about how lucky I am. You know.
This government rolled the program out called Family Hubs. And Family Hubs were, are Family Hubs significantly different to Sure Start?
They are massively different. And I have to say, and if you heard the Radio 4 interview, I almost started with it. Andrew Leadsom's Start for Life is fantastic. Yes. Yeah. It's really, first of all, it's very limited. It's not even 0 to 3. It's minus 9 months to 2. It's the first 1,000 days. And yes, it has all the key elements and others that we didn't have. It has a big digital program in terms of apps and stuff, parenting apps and reminders and all that, which, of course, we didn't have that stuff when we were doing Sure Start. No. So it has moved on. But in terms of core elements, I think it's really, really good. And it's in half of local authorities, I think, in England. And it is linked to a Start for Life program will be within a family hub. My argument about family hubs is that they're less well-funded and they're for 0 to 19s. And I don't know what common features would be in a center that's catering to 8-year-olds, 14-year-olds, and 2-year-olds. I just don't understand it, which makes me think, and it is my experience of family hubs, that they're mainly about children's social services. They're not about wider service integration and certainly not about parent participation. And it's not the sort of granular feel. So I don't have much optimism for family hubs, but I have great optimism for Start for Life. And the most important, you know, the reason that I give Andrew credit, Andrew led some great respect, is she got money out of Treasury for babies. I mean, just nobody's done that. I mean, it's just fantastic. You know, she got money out of Treasury in the teeth of austerity. You know, it's not a lot of money. It's not a, you know, but she did it. And I know her because I work in Northamptonshire and she's an MP in Northamptonshire. But I have huge respect for what she's done.
Is that a good, as we approach the end of this interview, is that a good place to think that Labour might come in and say, well, this is working. Andrew Leadsom's laid the foundations. Let's pick this up and run with it.
Wow. Yeah, I hope so. I mean, the truth is, I don't know. I hope so. You know, there hasn't been just the IFS report. There was a report that Kathy Silver and I did for Nesta, which recommended, we call them children's campuses attached to primary schools. So you use the infrastructure that's already in place and build onto that so that ensures that you have teachers, but also ensures that you have a space where families go to anyway with young children. So there are lots of things, and some Sure Start children's centers were attached to primary schools, and it always seemed to make a sensible way to do it, you know, particularly if lots of families have a preschool child and a child in school. So, you know, just trying to make it as easy as possible for as many people as possible in poor areas are the key principles. So I would hope that that happens. I would hope that they keep Start for Life and build on it, because I think that the key elements of the program are really, really good. I just don't know. David Bell is doing a review. I'm sure that he's seen the IFS stuff. Kathy Silver and I made sure that he saw the report that we did for Nesta, which was specifically on narrowing the gap. So I'm hopeful, but I'm disappointed that they haven't said anything. But yes, I realize that that's a tactic, you know, in the sense that the main thing is to get elected.
Well, we'll see sometime in this autumn. And Naomi, thank you so much for this interview. I've really enjoyed it. I've learned far more about Sure Start than I ever knew at the beginning of this interview. So Naomi, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, John, and thank you for your teaching of Nathan.
And that brings to an end another episode of the Friday Morning Break with John Gibbs here on Teachers Talk Radio. My guest this week was Naomi Eisenstadt, first director of the Sure Start Program. If you enjoyed our conversation and you wish to listen to it again, or missed it the first time, you can find it on Spotify, on Podbean, on the Teachers Talk Radio site, and many other platforms. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.